All right, we are here on the CMC podcast with Wayne Leroy, John McKentley joining us this time, and me, Kelly Byrne. We are talking about, is the belay competency drop test and whistle test still a valid test method or rigging paradigm? So there's been lots of talk and debate on it. There's been multiple competing presentations at the International Technical Rescue Symposium. For those who might need a refresher, the belay competency drop test is a 200 kilogram mass falling 1 meter onto 3 meters of rope with no more than a meter slipping through the device. And the maximum arresting force felt on the anchor should be no more than 15 kilonewtons. And that's now an ASTM standard. I think it's ASTM 2436. Right. Yeah. Okay. So that's, I mean, it's supposed to be representative of a fall onto a second line, you know, from your main line during an edge transition. Is that everybody's understanding of it? Or anybody ever hear it a different way?
But basically, edge transition gone wrong, right? That's kind of the...
That's what it was, supposedly the worst-case scenario.
Yeah, and actually, that would be right here in Arner's paper from 1990.
I thought it was 89, but okay.
actually, it was 1990, and the only reason I know that is I dug through my files. And it was from the British Columbia Council of Technical Rescue. So, yeah.
Was that just the piece of paper you had laying around, or did you, like, is that findable online, do you think?
Good Lord. I have no idea. I got this from Arner, and so did John in person.
Oh, no kidding.
Oh, yeah. Back when, you know, back when John was still weaving rope out of vines and things like that.
Yeah. No, that's so that was that a Nader's presentation, which was pre-Eiders? Was that what that was from?
I think the original, John, correct me if I'm wrong, was in the 80s. The one that I've got a copy of is in the 90s.
Okay.
The original, this is from August of 90, was Arner's paper. So that would have been Nader's world.
Yeah, that was definitely the Nader's time frame. Well, it was actually the transition time.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I take it back. Sorry. No, that was definitely the Nader's time frame. And I had something from 89, which is why I said that, but it was probably exactly the same. And just, you know, where it went out and depending on the timing, you know, when it got presented and all that.
Yeah, I think the one that you're referencing is the one, the testing from Sedona in 89.
No, actually, what I was thinking of was something else, but still, yeah. I thought the testing from the testing of Sedona with John Dill and Arner and Reed and all them, I thought was even after that. But
really?
I don't have a copy of it, so.
No, the first ones were, according to the paper, were Denver, I'm guessing Estes Park, in 87, and then Sedona in spring of 89.
Okay.
All right. Boy, I'd done some looking earlier. I couldn't find it. I thought that I was looking for that very test.
I'll send you a copy if you want it.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. So did that precede John Dill's Are You Really on Belay, or was that his answer to, or was that a part of that whole testing procedure? Anybody know that? Like, I remember hearing about that paper and reading about it, but it's been, you know, probably 10 years since I've looked at it. John, do you know that answer?
I don't know the answer. I'm trying to find it.
I gotcha. Which, interesting resource for those of you in listening land. You know, John's been around for quite some time, and I know Leroy's got a box of all of his Eiders folders, as do I. They're up in my closet, but they don't go back nearly as far, I don't think. Leroy, how far back does your personal database go there, Leroy?
My Nader's file?
Yeah.
Back to mid-80s.
Oh, really? Okay. Man, that's unbelievable. Like, and that's you should scan that and make copies for the world, because, like, if you have a flood, we're going to lose them all, you know?
Well, you know what? what's really hard is moving all the stones.
Yeah, right. The tablets.
Well, the unfortunate thing is back in those days, you know, since then with Eiders, you know, we asked permission and wanted to put them all online and had some sort of an electronic database where people could access them. But back in the Nader's days, it really only went back 5 or 6 years, a few years ago, because it was so difficult chasing the people down and finding permission and everything like that. And so certainly back in the 80s, none of that stuff exists out there unless somebody has posted it in, for another reason. Wow. Or referred to it in something else and you can find it. But it's difficult to find those things now.
Seems like a bit of, you know, that's a pretty hefty amount of institutional knowledge that's just hiding in, you know, bankers' boxes in the basement, you know? I wonder what it would take to get those out to the general public. That'd be kind of cool to do.
I don't have a problem scanning and posting and doing whatever.
Sure.
Well, I mean, I'll dig up what I've got. I've only got like 4 filing cabinets full of things. So.
Yeah, sure. It's like nothing. Just take you a couple of years that we all have in reserve, right?
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Yours is probably more organized than mine is. And I know yours goes back further. I don't think mine goes back. There might be something from the 80s, but not from originally. You know, getting it, you know, got it from somebody. But
well,
the big issue is, again, kind of back to what you were talking about, is it's all good ancient history, but, you know, is it something we still want to pay attention to? And then permissions on those things aren't, or pretty much disappeared from the rescue world anyway.
I guess he won't see if it's published or not then, but
well, somebody will rat us out. You know.
No, I'm sure of it, but, now, even if you don't pay attention, like even if it was not relevant to what's going on now, it'd be a neat history path, I think, for people to be able to trace. You know, if you know, we're all students of the game, and I think if we to go back and look at where we were and, you know, where we are now, is that would be kind of cool. And, you know, a lot of stuff like the, you know, the twin tension stuff, which is going to come into this belay competency here in a second, is pretty neat. I was looking through an old book I had, which is like a compilation of other papers by a guy who used to run a training group out of Pennsylvania. He would just, you know, put a bunch of stuff together. But I mean, twin tension stuff was in there, you know, two ropes through a single rack, or, you know, running a rope through a rack with prussics in front of it. You know, that the twin tension is nothing new. I think people saw the benefits of it. It's just been recently we've had a device that can, you know, act as a friction device for a lower and for a raise, as well as a competent belay that we kind of, I guess it's kind of come back around. Is that the general gist of how you guys would feel?
Actually, yeah. John, I know you were there. If you would remember, this was Nader's, would have been 88, where the, guy from San Diego lifeguards got vilified for doing their twin tension. Well, we would refer to it as twin tension now, on the way they did rescues on the ocean front. Mm-hmm. So what's old is new again, or it ain't different.
No. Everything comes full circle.
Yep. Yeah,
it absolutely does. So, you know, the belay competency test pretty much assumes, you know, nobody's touching the device, right? You know, it's really just a look at whether it can arrest the load, you know, when it falls the prescribed distance. But, you know, how do you have a good test to test something where you have to let go of it to make it work, you know, like the MPD, letting go of the handle, you know, the ID, you would have to let go of the handle. And, you know, if you went to a 2-person load, you would still need the secondary friction carabiner, which you don't use generally when it's, you know, when you're sharing the load. Like, is there a way to account for people, not just the device, I guess, or a human interaction with that belay test And he,
I think if you look at it in general at everything, I mean, aviation, everything, right? The human factor is always the unknown, and it's something you really can't test for, which is why all these things appear to be non-human, because the human factor is so variable.
Sure.
One of the things that you've said there, and you know, as far as an ID running the rope through a carabiner and then having to hold on to it's probably doesn't always work. But I've kind of always advocated if you're going to be using the MPD. You know, we've all seen the videos, Tom Pendley and others, where the guys forget to let go because they're trying to hold on to it and they physically can't as that load accelerates. And I've always said, you know, put the device out of line a little bit so it almost rips it out of your hand and has to.
Sure.
You have to let go because so often the people want to hold on to the load and can't. And then they, you know, they override the safety of the device. And in some cases you can't do it, but that was the reason for that, you know, and that goes back to the Eiders arguments from, you know, the early 90s with, using a lowering device or something like that as a, you know, using a figure eight or a Munter hitch or whatever, that required hand friction. And I can remember an ASTM meeting with Arner Larson and some of them when we were talking, and Kirk Mothner's discussions at Nader's and then Eiders about having to use an artificial hand because we were so afraid somebody would grab onto the rope and actually be able to hold it and rip their hands through the device.
Right.
I made one kind of artificial hand and Kirk made another, and those were kind of floating around for a while. I think there's one in an ASTM standard even.
I mean, that's pretty interesting. That's probably interesting backstory on that, like just two plates clamping with spring pressure or something.
Yeah, the one I did was, you know, parallel plates. Exactly. I had springs underneath wing nuts and two parallel plates, and the rope went down the middle, and you could adjust, you know, how tight the springs were. Kirk's was more of two spring plates, but a single spring, and the rope went around and did kind of a 180 around the spring.
Yeah.
Nice. Now, wing nuts on rope. That's totally appropriate for a belay test, I suppose. The, you know, I pulled a quote from a Douglas Adams book, you know, a common mistake that people make when trying to design something completely foolproof is to underestimate the ingenuity of complete fools. And I think that's I think with all of the systems, like, you're just not, it's going to be really difficult to engineer the human factor out of it. And I think,
yeah, and for it to be repeatable, right? I mean, you can't replicate a person.
You can't. And, you know, that's, you know, a bunch of years ago, I had written something on my website about that. You know, how do you apply an equal rule about not letting go to a device during a belay event? Like, you can make any belay device fail if you put the right person in there. And if you give me your belay device, I guarantee I can fail it. Like, you know, mm-hmm. on purpose, of course. So I don't know that there is a way to do that, to account for the human factor, other than just, you know, consistent training. Is the belay competency drop test the best? Is that the best, most real world test? Like, how many would we be better off having a test while we're over the edge, you know, with a load already in movement rather than a, you know, a slack belay during edge transition? Do you guys see a better place for it?
I personally, I think that we all know that the biggest risk takes place at the edge, right? Yep. The edge transition is the highest risk event.
Fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a rigging problem, that's when it's going to occur. That's when it's going to rear its face the second that system becomes loaded.
And I don't care if it goes, I don't care if the load is coming in or if the load is coming out.
Okay.
We all know if, right? When's the last time you saw a vortex or whatever tip over on the way in or on the way out?
So I had one going on the way in, like, and that was my fault, but I was the goofball on the rope, but it was at the edge. It was never, mm-hmm. you know, it was not while I was free hanging. What about you?
Same thing. It was actually coming in because everybody's OCD on the way out.
Sure. Yeah. No, I mean, the edge transition is, you know, is a big part of it. I mean, twin tension on a raise like that, you're not going to get any drop on that. But I don't disagree. I was just throwing it out there. John, what are your thoughts?
I was thinking that, you know, and on the raise, the twin tension is so much easier to maintain. So if you do have your high directional tip or something like that, it's probably less of a big deal because the ropes are going to be tensioned, or, you know, more easily tensioned than they are the other way around. But obviously I think that going down or making the edge transition and probably going down because you have the likelihood of it's the first time the system has been loaded probably. So yeah. If there was something wrong with it, it's going to show up there. Once the load is over the edge or the, you know, even if it was coming from the bottom and you were hauling it up, it's less likely to show up instead of that transition. And especially where you have the possibility of, you know, one rope being slack and then a surge going on the other rope, which is, of course, the whole theory behind the belay competency.
Sure. Cool. I guess in that, bringing the vortex into it, and it just as a thought for another show, like, you know, do we put it high through the vortex or not, or temporarily or not? Like, that's, there's always a good debate for that. I think I definitely have my feelings on that, but I think we could do it. I think we will do a whole other show on that one.
Absolutely.
So I guess, so how about the whistle test? You know, we use the whistle test as a rigging paradigm, how to rig, you know, if somebody blew a whistle and everybody put their hands up, the load would not drop to the ground. That seems pretty, I don't know if antiquated is the right word. I mean, it's a good thought, but I think with the modern equipment, ID, clutch, MPD, what have you, like that's pretty much, does anybody really still have to account for that anymore? Like, I guess we do, but, you know.
It's just a way to illustrate the hands-free, non-human intervention thing. By saying the whistle test and everybody lets go, that way the device is totally on its own and, you know, you're not really using it, but it's just a way to get, it's kind of a little more of a graphic example of nobody's touching the ropes, nobody's holding on, because it's really easy to see that friction device belay, you know, in most cases, we'll say the Munter hitch, obviously it's not going to work if you're not holding on to it, and that makes it graphic. The thing I'm concerned about is some people don't get the word, and I know we've always been very careful about talking about it when we talk about the whistle test, is like, hey guys, it's a conceptual deal, but I'm amazed when I hear people think that you really do this, and it's like, no, that isn't really one of those deals where in the middle of the operation, just for kicks and giggles, we're going to blow a whistle and see what happens when everybody lets go. But I've had people that take it that way. And,
really? Wow.
Yeah, I know. It amazes me, but it's kind of like I go out of my way to explain it because I should probably go back and find it, but I've really seen it written that way, and you just want to shake your head, but whatever.
So I guess is there a corresponding test for what happens when you don't let go? Like that's because I was always, you know, and I got a follow-up question to that, but you know, again, I think it comes back to that human interaction. Like, you know, the test, if you do let go, it's so everybody, you know, feels safe on their system, I suppose. But you know, what happens if you don't let go? What happens if failure one occurs and then somebody doesn't let go? I have not been able to think of an adequate test for that. So it's just always been a curiosity to me. But where was I going? Oh,
actually, Kelly, you know,
to tie into that a little bit, I guess I kind of thinking and looking at the twin tension thing.
Right.
Right. If one line fails, is it still controllable? That's where I kind of go to. So you're descending.
Yep.
Right. We're lowering, and we all know that forces are lower when you're lowering. than when you're raising.
Right.
But one line fails.
Yep.
Make it up, doesn't matter.
Sure.
Is it still a controllable event on the way down? On the way up, it's a given. We all know it's not going anywhere.
Right. Yep. Agreed.
Right. And to me, that's kind of an interesting concept. Is it a controllable event as opposed to a drop test? If you kind of know where I'm going,
I do, and it ties into this other point I had here, which. And it really, like, it's no, if anybody knows me, it's not a secret that I'm a Twin Tension fanboy. But when we look at other rescue systems or just analyzing systems, we don't account for a second point of failure. You know, like if the first rope is cut, you know, what happens if the first rope fails and the operator doesn't let go of the second one? Like that, we don't apply that to any other metric in our rope systems, you know, which we don't ever add a second point of failure. And I guess the flaw in that is that, you know, what if failure one causes failure two, which is, you know, the controllable load like you're talking about, Leroy. So I don't know, because I used to get real bent out of shape at first. You know, I'd say, yeah, it's fine if we fail one line, the second one will catch it, you know. But, you know, well, what if the second one doesn't catch it because the guy holds the handle open or whatever? Like, well, fuck, what else do we apply that to, you know? Nothing. But I think I was just being a little too stubborn in my beliefs.
Well, you could have some sort of cascading event like that, and it would turn catastrophic, obviously. There's, you know, most of the time is only, you know, you got two ropes, and if it's a vertical situation,
yeah,
the first rope fails and something happens to the second rope. And that was one of the reasons why Kirk Mothner and others were advocating twin tension ropes, because the potential for damage by going from 50% of the load, you know, theoretical,
yep,
to 100% was only half as big of a deal as going from 0 to 100. And you know, the testing he did over steel beams, and you can imagine in other places, just even on an anchor,
sure,
that that was one of the big reasons for twin tension.
Yeah, definitely. And for those listening, if you're interested in finding out more about these papers we're talking about, there's a couple of them. Kirk Mothner on the ITRS website, itrsonline.org, did some edge tests in 2014. Rigging for Rescue had their two tension TWO, two tension or not to tension, which is, it's on their website. That was 2019. Russ McCullough did two presentations, one in 2015 and one in 2017. Tom Penley has had a couple articles and some as far back as 2010 with like tandem prussic belays. And then also he did some testing with twin tensions with, I think, MPDs, and then also with ASAPs as well.
Yeah, he did. MPD just flat out belay testing. Yeah.
Yep. I was reading the other day in preparation for this, the Russ McCullough, McCullar, his 2017 ITRS paper, an analysis of the modern day belay, competent belay or competent belayer. And while I think he and I aren't 100% agreement on what the best belay method is, I think I agree 100% with him about, you know, competent belayers and good training are probably the more important than anything else in the whole chain of events there.
Well, that's definitely true. And in one of Tom Penley's tests in Arizona, that was exactly it. He took novices that weren't familiar with the devices and really didn't know what they were doing in most cases, I think. I think he did that on purpose.
Sure.
Was to test the devices with people that didn't know how to do it. And you still see issues if you don't know how to do things. But, you know, we had one the other day on a call that I was on, but, you know, it was no catastrophic big deal. But, you know, people that don't adequately train with the devices. And so that was, you know, part of Russ's thing. But you can't, and probably for the listeners, all these things should have a caution in front of these articles. and presentation, in as much as that there are biases in some cases and they're not peer reviewed. And it's kind of like we say at EITRS every year, it's like, try this on your own. It's reason for thought, but don't take everything you read as the absolute truth without really looking into it, because there are some flaws and some testings and things we've seen over the years.
Most definitely. There's a lot of biases in there, and it's, you know, on the inside baseball side of things, you know, once you know the players and are reading their papers, you're like, oh, I know exactly what angle they're angling for.
Sure.
But
for the listeners, we're all smiling at each other right now.
Yeah.
You know, in my thing is I always ask guys in class, and I ask my guys when I was still on the job, where do you want your best guy as far as skill set is?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's got to be the belay man.
He has to be.
But it's usually not that.
No,
but
it's not.
He's normally the guy that's hanging over the edge, or he's running the show.
Right.
And you kind of go, wait a minute, that's a waste of skill right there.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And that's
well, I think that's probably one of the reasons why the gear is so strong and all these things, because let's face it, lowest common denominator is the person, not the gear. Right. True. We would to all think that everybody's really well trained, but it's simply not the truth. I mean, okay, so a guy took a class. How long ago did he take it? Who did he take it from? What were that instructor's beliefs? I mean, this goes back to why the gear is the way it is.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the factor of ignorance, right? Like that's, I think we're trying to account for that. So with that, you know, I know, there's, without being too, I guess it's a little CMC centric because this is a CMC podcast, but you know, when the clutch came out and the YouTube marketing video associated with it, they showed four different ways of using it. I think it was four. So I'll spit out the four and then we can talk about them. Two separate operators on two separate anchors. So one guy on anchor one with a clutch, person on anchor two with the clutch. Then we had two operators, you know, each with their own clutch and one person tailing their rope for them. One operator operating both clutches, still having the slack rope in his hand. But and one person tailing, and then one operator with an ASAP on each line. So, you know, that's definitely, you know, we're trading equipment for manpower. But, you know, I always put those to my guys at work. Which one of those is the safest? You know, that it would, I don't know. Like, I guess we got to figure out what we're accounting for. I'm going to spit out my thought. I think one operator with an ASAP on each is the safest. Like, you're not going to outsmart an inanimate object. You know, I think gone the farthest for taking a human out of the equation. You know, that he's not thinking about what's for dinner or answering his cell phone. But any thoughts on this? For
or not thinking the other guy's doing it.
That's a very well. I'm gonna write that down. I got to get back to that. But what were you about to say, Wayne? Sorry.
I was gonna say I think you're right in the sense that one operator with ASAPs is the safest because you remove that human element. The concern I think that I've always had is, you know, the ASAP requires a certain speed to activate.
Sure. Know?
And this always seems to be brought up in the vertical environment. But think about a low angle environment or a steep angle environment in the wildland.
Sure.
There was an incident here in Arizona, right, where the guy fell and he was able to fall fast enough where the belayer was able to keep up, despite the fact that it took what I believe it was 9 surgeries to fix his hands.
Oh, geez.
Right? So, yeah, I've always wondered, can a guy fall just fast enough to not trigger the ASAPs at the same time suffer some pretty egregious injuries?
I think the answer is probably yes, especially given that, you know, that you know of one that happened. My counter argument to that one is, you know, like the meme, you know, but did you die? You know, which is not a good, metric
And just to clear it up for the listeners, the fall was not ASAP related. It was tanaprosic belay rated.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. That's even more interesting.
But again, you think about it, the guy's able to fall and the belayer's able to pay out enough rope to keep up with that speed.
Sure.
There was some pretty significant injuries associated with that.
No kid, boy. After my 9 surgeries, I'd go find that guy and show him how good my surgeries fixed me up, you know?
Sounds like a communication. There's no yelling, falling, or anything like that. Yeah. I mean, how is it that the belayer didn't know the rope was going out that fast, you know?
I mean, he must have been furiously pulling rope through those prussics.
Well, you know what it is? It's probably not pulling ropes through the prussics, Kelly. It's probably one of those ones where they're holding the prussics open and not using the
– You know what?
Pulling the loop through because it wouldn't happen. Well,
And talking to Tom, he said that if I recall correctly, all he did is chalk them open.
What do you mean?
Held them in place, rope peeled through.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, yeah, if there's no bend of the rope coming into the prussic, you know, it's going to, stands a good possibility of sliding through, I suppose.
Well, and if it has the back friction on it or whatever you want to call it, so that you have to really kind of pull the rope through, it wouldn't happen either. But
yeah,
you can back to the human error, Kelly. The first thing you said with the ASAP, you've eliminated the people screwing things up.
Yeah, true. And I think it's such an equipment intensive bit, you know, putting ASAPs on clutches or MPDs or whatever, but
I think I received an email about this not too long ago from overseas.
Yeah,
and the guy was concerned about the use of the ASAP there, and our reply from our engineers was it's not the ASAP that's belay rated; it's the clutch that's belay rated. The ASAP is simply there to prevent, you know, an overspeed event, if you will. It's not an arresting device. The clutch is the arresting device.
It is. I mean, it ends up slowing the rope so the clutch can do its job, which I know when we did some belay drops with like 660-pound load, you know, catastrophic failure of the main line, you know, wide open on one of the handles, not even touching the slack rope. I mean, the ASAP locked it up, and then, maybe one or two stitching deployed, you know, 4 kilonewton force on the anchor kind of stuff. It was... I mean, for me, it was super impressive. Catastrophic wise, like that, I think that's an unbeatable combo. Like, something that can stop the overspeed, and then a device that'll, do all the heavy lifting on it. So
Kelly, let me get back to what I was saying. So yes, I do believe that the two clutches, one operator, ASAPs is by far the safest. Having said that, how many rescue teams currently carry ASAPs? So one I do really like is the one operator holding both handles because you're getting true 50-50 with the tailor in position.
Yeah.
Because you have that second brain, right? Yep.
I think you're right. I think that's probably on an even plane with the two ASAPs, you know, a backup person holding the ropes. And I know that's in EMBC. What does that stand for? The British Columbia Emergency Management.
Yeah.
Like on their paper that Kirk Mothner did, you know, talks a fair amount about tailing the rope. So, and all their tests were pretty darn positive with it. So,
yeah, the tailor is essential in their system. And they're not using clutches, they're using MPDs, but it's the same thing. It's having the tailor there is that second point of contact, and it's easier to rig and cost you less money.
It absolutely does. And that's we were doing belay tests at work. We ran two rope classes, and every class we dropped 400-pound loads on to our devices. We were doing I think MPDs on this one, and even telling somebody you're gonna fail the rope, like giving them the heads up, like I'm gonna fail a rope, at least once a class, one out of 16 students is like, we're going for an excessive ride if we're not decking altogether. And then we put a tailor on there, and the forces are even on the anchors, and very, very little drop. It's a pretty slick solution if you got an extra person on scene to do it. It's interesting that when you look at it on the surface that, one operator with, two devices and two ASAPs is safer than, potentially safer than two separate operators. It just seems kind of counter counterintuitive, maybe. I don't know if that's the right word.
It is. The only thing that you have to consider is that you need to have that anchor that's totally, absolutely going to be bomb-proof, because, I mean, there's ways, certainly ways to rig around it, but if you're going to have both of your devices together, they, without a lot of rigging grief, you've got to have some big bomber anchor. And in the British Columbia examples, it's no problem. They have huge trees. Whereas sure. In my real world, we don't always have that. If we're going off a vehicle or we have a big tree, no big thing. But then there's sometimes when we have things that are less desirable and we don't want to have all our eggs on that one anchor. And that's where it starts to get to be a little problematic with one operator and two devices.
Yeah, most definitely. Like they that ain't happening if you got to use two separate trees, not without a bunch of yoga, I guess. But
yeah,
maybe you can make it work. One thing I want to circle back around to, John, you had mentioned, you know, people worrying about the, you know, the other guys doing it, you know, like the other guys handling the load. And I know when I teach it, I think an interesting distinction, rather than like, hey, we're both lowering, it's definitely a mindset shift that you are the other guy's backup. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, functionally, it doesn't change anything. You're still both lowering somebody. But, you know, in the back of your mind, you have to be thinking like, I am fully anticipating that that guy's going to screw it up. And depending on who the operator is, it's really not that hard sometimes. But
don't even put the person in there. Just say something's going to happen to their anchor or some part of their system. And you can leave the personalities out and it's the same thing. Yeah, they still have fun. To be back. Remember, they're backing it up.
No, that's very true. Yeah, operating with that mindset that like, man, I am definitely the backup, even though you're still lowering, it has, I think it's helped out a bit from new operators. Mm-hmm. So, cool. Well, wrapping it up, I think, you know, we're the belay competency drop test is still, you know, I guess we're kind of saying that it's not outdated yet. Its time has not come to be gone yet. You know, it's still an adequate device test. It's still a pretty violent drop if anybody's ever seen it on video. And it's accounting for a problem at the worst possible case, you know, at the edge transition, right when the lines go from unloaded to loaded. Like if something's going to go bad, one, it's going to be because the, you know, you're right on the edge, you know, and you're scared getting over the edge. And then two, you're going to be proof loading your system initially. So I think that's, I guess it's still a relevant test method. And then the whistle test, what happens if everybody lets go? I think we agree that it's a better training, device, you know, or mechanism for teaching people, and, you know, not so much that you would actually blow a whistle to have everybody let go. But, I'm still curious about how you, what's the best test for people, you know, and I don't think there is one. Like, you know, let them catch falling, you know, belay falling loads, you know, often, cause it happens maybe in training and probably not after that. Do any of you guys have like an annual recert for that, or like on your teams, or when you were on your teams, or is that just like a training thing once in a while? I know for us it's just once in a while.
You talk about belaying a falling load.
Yeah,
you know, I was on a committee for the state of California several editions ago of NFPA. McKentley was also with me, and we actually at that time NFPA required the drop.
Okay.
And we actually had, man, what are we going to do? We're going to have to get a whole separate cache of gear for people.
Sure.
To drop this stuff onto. And then luckily, they updated the NFPA during that time and it allowed to have a hard, unexpected, you know, yank on the rope suffice, because it does go through a lot of equipment and a lot of departments can't afford to be dropping gear and putting gear out of service to satisfy that requirement. I mean, especially if you work for a large department.
Sure.
You know, that's catastrophic. That's a lot of money.
It is, but you almost wonder if it's worth it. Like, it's the most critical thing, you know?
No, agreed 100%, yeah.
But, yeah, that's hard to justify dollars and cents-wise, so.
Yeah, I think in a perfect world, I would agree with you. In a perfect world, it should be done.
Sure.
It's just that the real world that we all have to live in is like, well, Yeah. It's kind of hard to justify to the bosses why I'm doing this and spending all this money.
Yeah, no doubt, especially if we're not having catastrophic mainline failures all the time,
right.
Which
yep.
is another thing. I just don't think we're having that.
Now, it's amazing the effort that the community as a whole puts into this when these things aren't happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think our efforts would be better directed, you know, elsewhere. But yeah, I mean, it's yeah, I just don't see it happening that often. So
is that all right? So hey, Kelly.
Yeah, yeah.
Here's something for you.
Okay.
Could you do some research for me?
Oh boy. Yeah. Sounds like a great yeah, Irish presentation.
John knows where I'm going.
All right, what you got?
When's the last time that there was a mainline failure during a real operation as opposed to during training?
I'll do that research, but I imagine you already know what the answer is going to be. And I think, I don't know. I'm pretty into it, but I've not heard of one.
Nope. I'm throwing it out there for the listeners. I do know, and I'm not giving the answer.
Okay. Dagger.
Right. You know, that's one of those, on the next podcast things.
All right. All right, cool. That would be awesome. I don't know that answer. If I had to guess, I'd say it was a slack belay on an aerial ladder or something along the. No, I don't know.
No, I mean, yeah, and not in training, and then define failure. You know, like tripods and vortexes and whatever's tipping over and everything like that.
Oh, that I
yeah,
know. But yeah,
you
yeah.
know, we know about some of those, and they've been in training and they've been in real operations, but. Is that really a failure in the sense that the line snapped and the total load went onto the belay or anything like that, you know?
Yeah, no. Oh, yeah. No, actually, the only one of those I know thinking back on it was a training high line in Peru where the track line failed and they only had a single line from up above. And the attendant in the basket rider, you know, did a pretty gnarly pendulum swing. But
we've seen the video. It was probably on that one. But then again, that wasn't a matter of a belay, so it didn't really make any difference there talking about belays.
No, it really didn't. They didn't even have a belay. So
Kelly, I have heard people say that, yeah, we need to come up with something better other than the belay competence drop test. I've heard no solutions, however.
Yeah. Me neither.
Right. Yeah. A lot of people say, hey, this needs to go away or this is antiquated. Okay. Sure. With what
you got,
and the conversation ends right there.
It's been there for a long time, and people can find little flaws with it. We've been through things on it, you know, the flaking shelf arguments, and there's still people that fight it. But it's like, what's the alternative? And back to something you said earlier, we used to do that on our rescue team. We used to do testing, and it really because it was kind of violent. And this was before we had tandem prussics, and remember we came from a climbing background and this was body belays, you know, before Grigri's and, you know, MPDs and tandem prussic belays and all that, where we literally had the rope wrapped around us, and it was cruel and unusual punishment because we used to drop essentially what would be kind of more considered a two-person type of load. It was 400 pounds. It wasn't exactly there.
That's enough.
But you know, we'd haul it up and drop it, and you had to hold it, and you had to get out of it. Ugh. And you know, this is obviously almost 50 years ago, and I used to sit there and go, "This is stupid." And I'd see people with rope burns on their backs and all kinds of violent things, and it was like, "Well, this is silly." You know, why do we do this? Why don't we get ourselves out of the system? But it came from climbing, where that was the belay in those days. You know, and that was when climbers were wrapping, you know, bowling on a coil around their chest for the belay and a lot of other things that hopefully were all passed. But
sure,
we used to do it. And then it came down to the deal, like Wayne said, you know, we can afford to smoke a couple of prussics and recycle the same rope as a drop test, but we've just really gone away from doing it, you know?
Sure. No, absolutely. I'm glad I never had to experience that, that side of it. But, that's interesting. Like that's, you know, Wayne, your thought on, you know, people, you know, grousing about it and then not having a solution kind of goes to that line, you know, that, firefighters and rescuers by extension. You know, there's two things we dislike, you know, the way things are and change. So I think that's fits right into that, you know, like this belay standard sucks. Like, all right, here's a new one. This one sucks even worse. You know, like, what do you do with that? So I don't know. It's interesting. It's interesting to me. I've been thinking about it for a bunch of years now. Like, is there a better test out there? You know, can you test people like you test equipment? I think the answer is probably no, but, you know, at least, you know, your equipment's quality, whether your people are or not, is just a matter of training. So I think that's, as with everything else, you know, training is the key. So, anybody have any closing thoughts or issues I didn't cover with belay competency or, this whistle test thought?
Well, one thing that you talked about and started with Wayne with writing something different for all of us and certainly those of us on this panel that have been so involved in testing and in standards writing and all sorts of things, it's easy to complain about it and it's really hard to do. And thinking of many, many hours, Wayne talked about it with, you know, complying with a standard to try and set up a training or testing program is difficult, and writing those standards and trying to make everybody happy and make it real and repeatable and everything like that is very difficult. And I don't want to discourage anybody listening from getting in that. And I'm really hoping that we get some new brains in there looking at those things to do that. But it's just a lot of work. It takes a lot of time.
Yeah, no doubt. And I've been privy to see a little bit of it, you know, in the back end, and more work, paperwork wise too, than what interests me. So, but I mean, there definitely has to be a next generation stepping up at some point. So, you know, who knows, maybe when I retire from the fire department, I can, get as involved in standards as you are and have been, John. Like, that's you got your fingers in like all the standards, don't you?
Well, kind of, but I'm phasing out. We need new people to do it. You know, some of us are running out of ideas, and the trouble is you need such a wide variety of experiences to write these things to cover everybody, be it for, you know, fire rescue or other kinds of public safety rescue, wilderness,
sure,
rope access or whatever, you know.
No, definitely. That's boy, if you can hang on for 4 years and 25 days until I retire, maybe I can I can help you out. But I don't know. Cool. Yeah. Leroy, any closing thoughts?
No. I don't think there's a great answer at this point.
Yeah.
I just don't. We all look to that thing. Whatever that thing is, right? Yep. Whether it be an ASAP, whether it be two guys or whatever, it's like Wayne said, least common denominator. We have to be smarter than our equipment.
Yeah.
Which in some cases,
yeah.
you know, and being a truck guy for 20 plus years.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. That's
you know, sometimes force isn't the best option. Well, so
weak mind and strong back usually works, but yeah, and rope rescue,
yeah, but
maybe not so much. But
yeah.
No, yeah, nope. You're I think you're right on that. Wayne, any closing thoughts here?
Nope, I kind of said my piece to you earlier, Kelly. Thanks.
Right on. All right. Well, for John, Leroy, and Wayne, this is Kelly Byrne signing us off for the belay competency drop test and whistle test. We'll catch you on the next one.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.